I should tell you that this church does not have an official position on a wide range of controversial topics. And the members of this church rejoice in their right to disagree with any opinion I express from this pulpit. There may be several of those this morning. If you're here with us often, you know already that two or three times a year I do what I call a potpourri sermon, in which I use unrelated bits and pieces that are too short for full-length sermons, but I think are too useful to throw away. They are usually in three parts, like the one this morning, and despite the alliteration of the title, the sections are not related to one another. We'll bring them up in order. Item one, the clinic I have in mind is in Oklahoma City, where my son recently agreed to be an abortion clinic escort. I've never had that experience, but we share exactly the same sentiments. Abortion presents a profoundly irreconcilable moral dilemma. Good and sincere people honestly disagree and have no intention of relinquishing their position. They disagree on when life begins. They disagree on what the Bible says about abortion, which I happen to think is nothing at all. And they disagree over who should make the final decision about continuing or ending a pregnancy. I have some friends who have come to feel, because of recent events, that all anti-abortionists are fanatics. But it is not true. I believe in the sincere convictions of thousands of such people, and I respect and defend their right to believe as they choose. But I also stand firmly in a tradition that is uniquely American, of seeking to protect the rights of those who hold a different opinion and who wish to follow it without being victims of violence. I am not surprised that when my son was invited to be an escort, he accepted. And to make it clear that he was a minister who believed in a woman's right to make that often agonizing decision for herself, he wore a clerical collar he bought years ago for some special occasion. Blue jeans from the waist down that day, but a clerical collar around his neck. Sons often inherit fashion taste from their fathers. As the car he was in entered the clinic grounds, a woman who would close the clinic, if she could, suddenly jumped in front of the car, fell backwards, stiff and screaming, and shouted as she hit the ground, "They attacked me. Arrest them." The police officer nearest her said, "Ma'am, nobody touched you." "Call 911, she said. "I've been hurt. They hurt me." So an ambulance came and took her away, at which point my son wrote me, "I realized I had entered a world so unreal, so fanatical, so consumed by absolute certainty about the will of God that I would never be quite the same. When a small black pickup arrived with a young woman inside, he went up with several others to cover the windshield with signs that read, "Prayerfully pro-choice." A group called the Lambs of Christ lay in the driveway, were ordered to stop blocking it, refused, and were arrested, which was what they had hoped for. Just before the last one was led away, a single female protester appeared suddenly behind my son and reached through the partially open window to grab the young woman inside by the throat. My son pulled that protester's arm back out of the drive, out of the window, and a policeman escorted her away. As the truck moved off the grounds, someone yelled, "Kill the one in blue jeans." The irony of it all was that during the long wait to clear the drive, my son had had an opportunity to talk with the girl in the truck. She had come not to have an abortion, but a routine pregnancy test. But irony is a situational oddity he can easily forget. What he keeps remembering is the look on the face of the one who yelled, "Kill the one in blue jeans." Item 2. Dorothy Dix, a sort of early Miss Manners, once defined what it means to be a lady in these words: "A lady is one who fears God, tells the truth, and doesn't complain." Complaining probably sounds pretty trivial when you name it in the same sentence with respecting God and telling the truth. But the fact is that it's one of those seemingly minor character traits that eats away at good relationships, easily becomes an invincible habit, and robs the one who does it of any hope of happiness or friendship. Even friends tend to head off in another direction when they see a habitual complainer approaching. I read a day or so ago about three people who arrived at the pearly gates at the same time. St. Peter came up, but he said he had some pressing business and would they mind waiting. He was gone a long time, but finally came back and called one of the new arrivals in and asked if she had minded waiting. "No," she said, "I've looked forward to this day for so long, I don't mind at all." Peter smiled and said, "Well, I have one more question. How do you spell God?" She said, "Capital G-O-D. St. Peter said, "Go right in." He went outside and got another new arrival, told him to come inside, and said, "Did you mind waiting?" The man said, "Oh no, I've been a disciple for 50 years, and I'll spend eternity here. I didn't mind at all." Peter smiled again and said, "Just one more thing. How do you spell God?" This man said, "G-O-D. No, I mean capital G." Peter said that was good and sent him on into heaven. Then he went back out and invited the third person in and asked her if she had minded waiting. "As a matter of fact, I certainly did," she said. "I've had to stand in line all my life, at the supermarket, when I went to school, when I registered my kids for school, when I went to the movies, everywhere, and I resent having to wait in line for heaven." Peter said, "Well, I understand how you may feel that way, and we won't hold it against you. But there is just one more question. How do you spell Czechoslovakia?" It's appropriate to tell a story involving the apostle because complaining is a biblical theme. The book of Exodus tells us repeatedly how the Israelites complained against Moses. He has led them out of Egyptian bondage. They have a chance finally to be free. So what do? They murmur. A good onomatopoetic term. Murmur, murmur, murmur. They complain. Not enough food. And what there is doesn't compare with what they've had before. Not enough water. Too cold at night. Too hot in the daytime to walk in a desert. Would to God we were back in Egypt, they said, where at least we had straw beds and some food for our stomachs. They had by that time a chronic disease, and Moses got so tired of it, he wanted to leave them, which is not surprising since such people make poor company. The surprising thing is that according to the story, even God himself got so tired of listening to their complaints that he is represented as saying he doesn't trust himself to go along with them, that he might get so fed up he would just wipe out the whole bunch. What an extraordinary thing for some writer to say about God, proof of how irritating it can be to live with chronic complaint. And it does tend to become chronic, to turn into a habit. A long time ago, when cars were first put on the road, my family had a Model T Ford. It's about as early a thing as I can recall, but I do remember some ruts on country roads that could get to be a foot deep in winter mud. Our Model T stood up high, but sometimes we would get into a rut, literally too deep to get out of. And I saw a sign once when I was a kid that said, at the start of a long stretch, watch the rut you start in, you'll be in it for the next 20 miles. So the word this morning is, hear yourself talk. And if you find yourself in a rut, complaining all the time, remember that the difference between a rut and a grave is only a matter of depth. If you need a good teacher, visit our birthday lady this morning. I've never heard Ada complain about anything in the 22 years I've known her. Item 3, which I approach with some trepidation. My favorite crow often perches in our balcony on Sunday mornings. Attentive, wise, one of the true treasures of this church. But he is not the only crow in the family tree. Dr. Ernie Crow has a brother named James, also a distinguished physician, who is presently the emeritus senior research professor of genetics and zoology at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. I recently read parts of a speech he made about a year ago, and the comment struck me as so thoughtful and so bluntly honest about serious problems that I felt it would be worth your time to hear them. He talks about how modern medicine prevents or cures diseases that used to be fatal so that more and more of us live long enough to become totally dependent on family or society. What we'd like, he says, is to live in health and happiness right up to the moment of death at, say, age 94.7. But the freedom to choose the time, place, and manner of our own death is denied to most of us, either by law or by tradition. I, for one, he says, would like the freedom and social approval to choose to die while I am in reasonably good health and still have a brain, preferably after a jolly party with family and friends. And if I become mentally incapable, I want the choice made by a trusted relative or friend. I am completely sympathetic with Dr. Crowe's conviction that when life becomes intolerable, when there is nothing in the future but constant pain without hope of improvement, one should be allowed to make as easy and dignified an exit as possible. Perhaps in your lifetime, he says to his audience, our society will evolve socially acceptable customs to make the end of life better than it is now for those who no longer have a life. I like this man's courage. His lifelong studies have made him a firm believer in evolution, and it is clear that his hope for the future lies in the fact that we are still evolving. But the whole process may come to a screaming halt, he indicates, unless we do something very soon about overpopulation. Listen to his exact words for a moment. We have ozone depletion. We have global warming. We are using up oil and topsoil, and we have no coherent energy plan. We have a combination of xenophobia and poverty that is turning our cities into jungles. We have litigation strangling the economy. Decisions that should be made on rational grounds are being made so as to defend against lawsuits. Native habitats are being destroyed. I recently read that all five species of rhinos, I didn't know there were five species, he says, are on the verge of extinction. I don't know the practical value of rhinos. I do know that the presumed practical value of their horns is nonsense. But I would hate to live in a world without rhinos. It seems almost impossible for a democratic government to look into the future, especially if it involves some sacrifice at the present time. I hope the man who 4 years ago promised to be the environmental president will live up to this promise by going to Rio and playing an active role. End of quote. That hope, as we now know, didn't materialize. I think we can safely assume that this good doctor has had his hopes rekindled about the environment. But he really wins my heart when he says flatly what I have tried to say in a recent sermon, the greatest problem is population growth. If we don't solve this, nothing else matters. Most of that increase in world population, the good doctor notes, is in the poorest countries where parents are least able to take care of their children. African Rwanda, for example, holds the record with about 8 births per mother. Now listen carefully again to this plain-spoken Janet Reno of the medical world. The birth rate in the United States is relatively low, but every unwanted child is one too many. Every birth to a parent unwilling to try to care for it is one too many. Graduation speakers are expected to come out resolutely in favor of God and motherhood. I'm no authority on God, but I have a strong opinion on motherhood. I'm opposed to much of it. There is too much in the world. I am opposed to early teenage fatherless motherhood, he says, and he thinks just preaching will not do much to change all that. What we need, he says, is to develop better, simpler, and essentially cheaper methods of birth control. Research is handicapped by political pressures and fears of lawsuits. And then he quotes a New York Times editorial to the effect that if the French pill RU486 were readily available, abortion would be as private a decision as it should be. I mean, here's a guy who stands up before graduates and says something tough to them instead of tossing bouquets of cotton candy. He rounds off his speech by insisting for the third time that if we don't solve the population problem, nothing else matters. We may be the last generation, he says, in which reproduction is regarded as a right rather than something to be rationed. Is he hopeful at all about the future? Well, guardedly, he says. And then he adds, not the silly optimism of the man who fell off a tall building and as he passed each open window yelled, "Okay, so far." He reminds the graduates that they are very privileged people, blessed in so many ways that they owe society something in return. He reminds them that Mark Twain said once, "It is noble to do good. It is also noble to urge others to do good, and it is a hell of a lot easier." My advice, Dr. Crow says, is that we do both. So now I'm indebted to another Dr. Crow, whom I admire for being willing to offend about half the special interest groups in America in order to tell the truth as he sees it. I'm so grateful to him, in fact, that I've put his picture on the coffee table out in our Friendship Hall so you can see his face this morning and think about those strong Quaker parents who brought up 2 sons like the one you've known for years in Kansas and the one you've met this morning from Wisconsin. It's good to know that between their thoughtful and healing lives and the shouted cry to kill the one in blue jeans, there is an immeasurable and blessedly hopeful distance.